Hi, I'm Tawny Plattis, and I host the Dirty Bits podcast, a show where I very casually retell the sexy, scandalous, and salacious stories your teacher probably left out. We premiere a new episode every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Visit us at tawnyvoice.com/dirtybits to learn more. See you next Tuesday.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And today, I'm going to be talking about Belle Ganesse.
Ooh, And I am going to be talking to you about Melange.
Ooh, okay. All right.
Get ready.
Belle Ganesse was a serial killer.
My favorite.
In fact, she is known as one of the most prolific female serial killers, if not the most prolific serial killers that has ever lived.
Female serial killer.
Now, when her life began, when she was born, is actually up to some debate because there's no real... she was born in the mid-1800s, so there's not a lot of records around that time. And she was born in Norway, actually. And there's actually a sign-up. I saw this very brief documentary that was on YouTube about her. And there's a sign-up there, and the guy was very clear. He was like, this is not a sign commemorating or celebrating her life. It's just to mark the spot where this woman was born, right? So in Norway.
Okay.
At birth, she was Kristin Brynhild Podstadter Storseth, and her parents were named Paul and Berit, and her father was actually a stonemason. Now, just like Polycarpa from last week, she was one of eight children. She was the youngest, though. And her family lived about 60 kilometers away from the largest city in central Norway, which was called Trondheim at the time. Mm. Now, at 18, the story goes that she went to a dance while pregnant and was actually attacked by a man who kicked her in the abdomen, which caused her to miscarry. The man had come from a really rich family and was actually never prosecuted by the Norwegian authorities. And apparently, after this incident, her personality changed. And the man who attacked her died shortly after. But the official cause was said to be stomach cancer.
AKA poison?
Yeah.
Just asking.
Yeah, maybe. The year after the attack, Belle began working on a large, wealthy farm. She worked there for 3 years before she'd saved enough money to emigrate to North America. And she actually was following in the footsteps of her older sister. And she moved at age 21 in 1881. And it was then that she adopted the more American-sounding name of Belle instead of Brynhild. Now, in 1884, she married Mads Ditlev Anton Sorensen in Chicago. And 2 years later, they opened a confectionery store together. Now, this business was not successful. And sometime after, the shop mysteriously burned down. And they had collected the insurance money and they bought a new house. And just kind of went on with their life. There's continued conflicting stories about how many children they had and the genders as to what they had, or if they even had children at all. Some say that they had no children. Some say they had four children, Caroline, Axel, Myrtle, and Lucy. But Caroline and Axel, if they did live, both died in infancy very early on from something called colitis. Funnily enough, the symptoms of which readily mirror the symptoms of many forms of poisoning. Both of their lives were insured, and Belle and Sorensen collected the insurance money after they died.
No.
Yeah. It was also during this time that Belle and Sorensen had adopted another daughter, Jeannie, as well. Now, Sorensen died on July 30th, 1890, the day on which his two life insurance policies overlapped.
What?
Right? So no one's putting all these suspicious events together. The first doctor that saw him thought he'd actually suffered from strychnine poisoning, but the family doctor had previously been treating him for an enlarged heart and claimed that his death was caused by heart failure. Because there was
strychnine poisoning?
No. because there was no suspicion of foul play, there was no autopsy in the end because the family doctor vouched for the previous treating of the heart condition. So Belle applied for the insurance money the day after the funeral. And while his relatives claimed that Belle had poisoned her husband for the insurance money and records suggested an inquest was actually ordered over it, it was never concluded. It was never actually carried out. And Belle was awarded $8,500, which is roughly the equivalent of $214,000 today.
Holy.
And she used the money to buy a farm.
Wowza.
As Belle was preparing to move from Chicago to LaPorte, she met a recent widower named Peter Ganess, who was also Norwegian-born, and they were married in LaPorte, this farm that she bought with the money from her previous husband, on April 1st, 1902. And 1 week after the ceremony, Peter's infant daughter from his previous marriage died of uncertain causes while she was alone in the house, guess who? With Belle. And then in December of that year, Peter himself was killed in a, quote, tragic accident. And according to Belle, he was reaching for his slippers next to the kitchen stove, and he was scalded with brine. When he jumped back, he bumped into a shelf, and the meat grinder machine on the top of the shelf fell on his head and killed him.
I just cannot. I cannot right now.
It's like some weird Rube Goldberg, like Final Destination death that's happening here.
I'm reaching. See, I thought you were going to say reaching for his slippers next to the fire when he fell into the fire.
Nope.
The meat grinder fell on his head.
He got scalded by brine that was on the stove, fell back, hit a shelf. The meat grinder fell off the shelf and hit him on the head.
Belle, have you seen the movie Fargo? Have you seen the movie Fargo? What is happening?
So Belle actually receives $3,000 for Peter's death, but the local town people refused to believe what happened to Peter. Because he ran a hog farm and was actually really well known and experienced and as a skilled busher. So it was hard to believe that he could be so clumsy, especially with a machine that was so central to the work that he was doing.
Oh, man.
The coroner reviewed the case and actually announced that Peter had in fact been murdered and organized a jury to look into the matter. But Belle was somehow able to convince the investigators that she was innocent. Around this time, Peter's oldest daughter, Swanhild, was brought to live with Belle from Wisconsin, and Belle actually was pregnant from Peter at this time as well.
Oh, man.
She gives birth to this son, and then her daughter goes missing. She tells people that she had just gone off to a Lutheran college in Los Angeles, but her body was actually later found many years later on Belle's property itself. So she is kind of just, she's just switching around children here.
My dad would always jokingly threaten, like, I'm going to trade you in for a new model. She's just trading people in for a new model.
Yeah, it's literally what happening. She's doing. And so now is when she actually starts getting into the routine of the killing that she gets into. So what she starts doing is she puts in classified ads in the newspaper looking for men who want to marry a Norwegian woman. Because at this time, she sells it as if she's a woman who's come from Norway and she wants to marry a Norwegian man so that she can continue tradition and she can give birth to Norwegian children. So she ends up having all of these suitors come to her. These are just normal men who all they want is a wife and a family and someone to go with. The advertisements went like this. It said, personal. Comely widow who owns a large farm in one of the finest districts in LaPorte County, Indiana, desires to make the acquaintance of a gentleman equally well provided with view of joining fortunes. No replies by letter considered unless sender is willing to follow answer with personal visit. Trifflers need not apply.
Trifflers. Do we Trifflers. Know what that means? Basically, like, if you're not willing to put out.
Oh, yeah. One who behaves lightly or not seriously.
Wow.
Flakes, as we call them these
flakes
days.
Flakes not apply.
Flakes need not apply.
Oh.
Triflers. Oh, so this announcement was followed by the response and visits of several middle-aged men. The first was John Moe from Elbow Lake, Minnesota, brought more than $1,000 with him to help Belle pay off her mortgage. She introduced him to her neighbors as her cousin and then disappeared from the farm a week later. Mm-hmm. Next was George Anderson from Missouri and was another fellow immigrant from Norway. During dinner together, Belle raised the issue of her mortgage, and Anderson agreed to help her pay it once they were married. In a later account, Anderson says that night while sleeping in the guest room, he awoke to see Belle standing over him, peering into his eyes, and holding a candle. He stated that the expression on her face was so sinister and murderous that he let out a yell, and she immediately ran from the room without saying a word. Anderson threw on all of his clothes and immediately fled the farm, looking over his shoulder the whole way until he made it to LaPorte. He was certain that if he'd stayed, Belle would have murdered him. He never went back for his belongings, and he never spoke to her again. More suitors came, but Anderson was the only one who made it off the farm.
What?
She began ordering these huge trunks to be delivered to her home.
Oh, come on.
And the driver who would deliver the trunks to her remarked how she could lift the trunk like boxes of marshmallows, and she kept the shutters of her house closed day and night. There are also stories that farmers driving past could see her digging with the with a shovel in the hog pen. And so, like, there's all these different signs, like red flags just everywhere.
There might as well. The FBI hasn't been created yet, but, like, for real, your local sheriff is really not pulling his weight here, gang. So, oh my God.
There's a there's actually a letter that they found from Belle to another suitor from December 1907 that said, this is what it read, this letter. It said, "No woman in the world is happier than I am. I know that you are now to come to me and be my own. Think how we will enjoy each other's company. You, the sweetest man in the whole world, we will be all alone with each other. When I hear your name mentioned, or I hear myself humming it with the words of an old love song, it is beautiful music to my ears. My heart beats in wild rapture for you. My Andrew, I love you. Come prepared to stay forever."
Oh my God.
It's that last line that really just makes you like,
Someone get Agatha Christie on the case.
So Andrew rushed to her in that same month, with him a check of $2,900, is all the savings he had withdrawn from his local bank.
No.
The two were spotted at the savings bank in La Porte, where they deposited the check together. And then he vanished a few days later.
No shit.
After this is when things actually start going bad for Belle. The tide starts turning against her. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily because of something that she did. It's because she had hired, when she originally bought this big farm from the insurance money from that one, the one particular husband that she killed, she'd actually hired a farmhand who was helping her to manage and maintain the farm. And eventually, this farmhand, his name is Ray Lamphere, grows to love Belle. In kind of like, I don't know, in some sick way, I would imagine. And he becomes jealous.
You heard of Stockholm Syndrome?
Right. And he becomes jealous of all the men that are coming in and all the suitors that are coming to try and woo Belle.
What does he think happened to them, though? Like, does he think that it just didn't work out?
I have no idea.
Like, we didn't really vibe. Our chemistry was off. So I sent him home.
And so he comes and starts making scenes on the farm and starts making getting in fights and starting and making a fool of himself. And so she fires him February 3rd, 1908, and then immediately goes to the public courthouse to declare that Ray had gone mad and was a menace to the public. He's put on trial for sanity, but was found sane and actually released and kept coming back to the farm where she kept having him arrested for trespassing. And so this kind of goes on back and forth. And eventually, Andrew's brother, Astley, becomes concerned that Andrew hadn't returned home and actually writes to Belle asking about his whereabouts. She replies that Andrew was no longer there, but had probably returned to Norway to visit his relatives. Astley didn't believe this and wrote to her saying that he still believed Andrew was in La Porte. And Belle invited him to her farm to search for him, but Astley would have to pay her for conducting the search. So Astley didn't come for quite a while. Belle becomes concerned about what Ray might say to people, so she hires a lawyer in La Porte and tells him that she fears for her life and the lives of her children because Ray had continued to threaten to kill her and burn down her house, according to Belle. She made out a will just, quote, in case, and then went to the bank and paid off her mortgage. And she never made a report to the police. There's no official report. It's all just her kind of telling these stories.
You listeners cannot see my face, right, but I'm having a very suspicious frown for about the past 90 seconds.
Right. So on April 28th, 1908, Joe Maxson, the man hired to replace Ray, awakes in his room in the second floor of the house to the smell of smoke filling the house. He jumps out of the second story window in his underwear in order to escape the flames and actually ran to town to get help. But by the time anyone was able to come back to the farm, it was gone. It was in ruins. Four bodies were found inside, one the body of a woman with no head, and the other three were Belle's children, Lucy, Myrtle, and Philip, still in their beds. Now, the sheriff had heard about Ray's threats, and after seeing the destroyed farm, he sought out the ex-handyman. They started looking for this man. And Belle's lawyer comes forward telling the story of her will and the fears that Belle had been going on about. And Ray denies the allegations, but a young man came forward named John Soyem, who was watching the Guinness House for some reason, comes forward and actually said that he'd seen Ray running around the road.
Oh, because Belle paid
like,
him.
Right as the fire started.
Let's be clear.
Exactly. Exactly.
Who's the headless woman?
Exactly. So that's what I'm...
What?
They don't know. Because the woman, the body didn't have a head. And so there's never an accurate ID of whether it's Belle or not. We don't know that she actually died in this fire.
But like, how could she, but she can't drop off her own head. Like,
no,
you,
exactly.
That, you can't do that.
Right. So the body of the burned woman was 5'3 and about 150 pounds. Many of Belle's neighbors stepped forward to say that they knew Belle was about 5'8 and weighed between about 180 to 200 pounds. Measurements from the stores where she bought clothes was used as a comparison to say that there's a good possibility that this is not her dead body. And the authorities actually come to the conclusion that it could not possibly be Belle.
Oh my God.
There was later found that a Dr. J. Myers, who examined the internal organs of the dead woman and sent them to a pathologist in Chicago, reported months later that the organs contained lethal doses of, guess what?
Strychnine.
Strychnine. I mean, it's literally crazy.
This is a Showtime miniseries. What is happening?
So here's a list of the bodies that were found in Belle's hog pen. Ole B. Budsberg from Wisconsin. Thomas Lindbaugh, who was the help prior to Ray. Gary Gernholt of Scandinavia, Wisconsin, who'd come to LaPorte to wed Belle. Olaf Svenhrund of Chicago. John Moe of Elbow Lake, Minnesota, and Olaf Lindblom, also from Wisconsin, are some of the named people. And it's believed that approximately 12 bodies in total were found on the farm, and the remains of 7 of the victims were reburied afterwards. Now, after unearthing these bodies, more reports started coming in, and it's rumored that she may have been responsible for the deaths of over 40 people. In her time as a serial murderer. Ray Lamphere, this help, was found guilty later of arson, but was actually acquitted of the murder of Belle Guinness because of all of the
proof that
evidence.
It
wasn't her body. And he was sentenced to 20 years in prison and actually died of tuberculosis in 1909. But before his death, Ray confessed to a minister of everything that had happened while he was working with Belle. He also swore that Belle was still alive, having faked her own death in the fire. He recounted how she would murder the men who came to visit her by making them feel comfortable and then drugging their coffee at night. When the men was in a stupor, she would split his head open with a meat chopper. Sometimes she would actually wait for them to fall asleep, and then she would chloroform them and then split their head open with a meat cleaver. She then carried all the bodies to the basement and dissected them using techniques that she learned from her butcher husband, Peter Guinness. Sometimes she'd just poison them. Sometimes she'd chop them up. Sometimes she would do all different kinds of things. And then she would either dump them into a vat with quicklime on it, or she would feed them to the pigs. Ray also admitted that he helped her set the house on fire, and he helped her put the body of the woman in the house as well. But then she betrayed him, and she's the one who set up the boy to see Ray digging in the house so that he would be implicated after helping her do all of these different things. To Ray's account, she had murdered 42 men in the time that he knew her and had accumulated more than $250,000 from him, which in today's money is the equivalent of $6.3 million.
And then she's just never heard from again?
There's reckonings of being seen an average about 2 reports of Belle Guinness for the next 20 years, and it's not really sure what happens. In 1931, there's a woman named Esther Carlson arrested in Los Angeles for poisoning a man and taking his money, and some people think that might be Belle Guinness. Two people who knew Belle in LaPorte claim that they recognize her from photographs from a different place. There's really no mention. She kind of just disappears into the wind and is not heard of again. The most prolific female serial killer ever to exist, probably.
I have nothing to say.
$6.3 million. So that's Belle Guinness.
Well, I'm going to have such good sleep tonight. I'm going to be talking to you about Melange. She is viewed as a traitor by some, as a traitor to Native Mexicans, but she was a crucial translator and advisor to Cortez, the Spanish conquistador.
Oh, yeah.
Their child... Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So I kind of also, when looking over her story, it reminds me a little bit of Sacagawea.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a difficult case because they did a lot each and were incredible women and helpful women.
Right.
But did they do the right thing?
Exactly right.
I don't know. So she was originally born Malinalli sometime around 1500. Mm-hmm. We don't have an exact date. And she was near a pretty large settlement called Kutsakalakos.
Okay.
She was named after the goddess of grass.
Oh.
So pretty cool. Her father was a chieftain and her mother was from the ruling family of a nearby village. Her father died when she was very young and her mother remarried to another local lord. Now, her mother had a son with her new husband and wanted the son to inherit all three villages that her husband ruled over.
Okay.
So she secretly sold Melange into slavery, telling everyone that she had died.
Oh, my God.
So she was sold to slavers who then sold her to the Lord of Potencan.
Okay.
She was a slave, but she was a highborn slave.
Sure.
So again, if we're thinking of another equivalent, I kind of am thinking of it more as a handmaiden in the Victorian era. You know, she wasn't the traditional idea that we think of as a slave.
Right.
But she was sold into slavery by her own mother.
Right. So levels of slavery.
Exactly. So just keep that in mind.
Right.
So in March of 1519, Hernan Cortez, the Spanish explorer, landed near Potencan, where she was living and where she was working for the Lord. And the local natives of the region didn't want to deal with the Spanish, so they started fighting each other. The Spanish obviously had more sophisticated armor, they had steel weapons, and they were very easily...
much more well-trained.
...able
to
defeat the natives.
Sure, of course.
The local leaders asked Cortez for peace, which he agreed to, and then the Lord brought him and the other Spaniards food and 20 women to cook for them, one of whom was Melange.
Oh, okay.
The girls were distributed to the various Spanish captains, and she was given first to Alonso Hernandez Portaquerraro.
Okay.
She was baptized and given a new name, Donna Marina. This was also the time that she gained the nickname, though, of Melange.
Oh, okay.
She had a strong grasp of language, and she could speak two of the native languages, Mayan and Nahuatl.
Mm-hmm.
And Cortez realized how valuable that she was, and so he took her back from captain and was like, nope, never mind, I'm gonna need her.
Uh-huh.
Because there was a man on the expedition who could speak Mayan, and Cortez would use a combination of the two to talk to the natives. However, Melange just quickly learned Spanish as well, and then there was no need for the second translator.
Okay.
So she was like, bye.
I'll do it all.
Yeah, I got you.
Right.
I got you.
Right.
You take care of me, I'll take care of you. Really good.
Right.
So she helped the Spanish understand the complicated government that the Aztecs had developed in central Mexico. And through this, she helped them gain the understanding of the native people. And this would eventually aid them in the War of the Conquest.
Sure, of course it would. Yeah.
So in September of 1519, the Spanish allied themselves with another native tribe called the Tlaxcalans.
Okay.
And they prepared to march to Tenochtitlan. Italian.
Yeah, a lot of difficult.
So many long names.
Native Pan-American names.
Exactly. And take control. And they were going to pass through a holy city when Cortez heard of a possible plot by the Aztec Emperor Montezuma to ambush and defeat the Spanish once they left the city, because it's a holy city, so they can't attack them in there.
Right.
I'm assuming. So Melange befriended a woman in town who was married to a leading military officer and was like, what up? What's going on? And the woman told Melange that she shouldn't leave with the Spaniards. Instead, the woman told her to stay and marry her son. And Melange was like, okay. But then she actually ended up bringing this woman to Cortez, who questioned her and confirmed his suspicions of the attack. So he gathered the city's leaders into a courtyard and accused them all of treason, using Melange as his interpreter. He then ordered his men to attack. This is known as the Cholula Massacre and resulted in the deaths of thousands of local nobles.
Oh, wow. Good Lord.
Right. So the Spanish continued on to Tenochtitlan and took the emperor hostage. Melange continued as an interpreter, but was also made an advisor, and she became Cortez's right hand, allegedly becoming his mistress.
Oh, wow.
He took Melange with him to fight fellow Spaniard Panfilo de Nevares, who was trying to take control of the expedition. So during this battle called the Night of Sorrows, in which the Spanish were almost defeated, Cortez had some of his best men defend Melanch and help her retreat from the city. She was also very important in communicating with the general populace of the town and even helped to quell some of the anger that they felt towards Cortez. So Cortez comes back, reconquers the city in 1521 with Melanch at his side. And in 1523, Melanch gives birth to Cortez's son, Martin. Their son was made legitimate by a papal decree. Martin is considered to be one of the first people of mixed European and indigenous American ancestry.
Oh, wow. Okay.
A year later, 1524, Cortez encouraged Melanch to marry one of his army captains, Juan Rejamillo, and she did. Because apparently Cortez's wife had finally arrived to New Spain. Oh. So, like,
sure, you the miss just gotta go, yeah.
Yeah, you gotta go. Melanch had a daughter with her new husband named Marina. Melanch was accompanying Cortez on his expedition to Honduras when they passed through her homeland. Her mother and her half-brother were still alive, and she met with them and forgave them for selling her into slavery.
Oh, wow. How very magnanimous.
For real. Yeah. I would be like, bye, bitch. Yeah. Peace.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who?
Right. So after Cortez successfully conquered the city, he awarded Melanch with several prime plots of land around Mexico City. She settled down and she likely passed away in 1551.
Okay.
Bernal Diaz de Castillo was a soldier from the Spanish and produced the most comprehensive eyewitness account called The True Story of the Conquest of New Spain. And he described Melanch as a great lady. He said, quote, without the help of Melanch, we would not have understood the language of New Spain and Mexico, end quote.
Mm.
And another conquistador recalled that Cortez once said that after God, Melanch was the reason for his success.
Oh, wow. So it definitely is. You can see how she could be hated by the...
Right. So in the history of the Tlaxcala, the tribe that they allied with, Melanch was always depicted at Cortez's side, but is also shown on her own, directing events on her own.
Oh, wow.
Pretty
cool. So, like, actually having the chance to lead events.
Exactly. So, other conquistadors recalled that her greatest strength was the ability to convince the natives that there was no point in fighting back against the Spanish, who had metal weapons and ships that were superior to the weapons of the natives. Which, she's not wrong.
Right. No, absolutely.
There are conflicting stories that after Melanch began assisting Cortez, the Spanish were forced into combat only one more time. Not really sure. Melanch's legacy has inspired mixed feelings for modern Mexicans, of course. Many despise her and consider her as a traitor to native Mexicans for her role in helping the Spanish invade. Others forgive her actions because she was a slave who was given away freely to the Spanish and she didn't really owe anyone her loyalty.
Right.
Something that Cortez and Melanch are, quote, an allegory for modern Mexico, the offspring of violent Spanish domination and native collaboration,
okay,
end quote. So that kind of makes sense. They do see her as a brilliant communicator who helped prevent the Spanish takeover from being even more violent than it was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, regardless of the feelings toward her, Melanch enjoyed more freedom and autonomy than most native or Spanish women had during the time.
Right.
So statues of her, Cortez, and their son, Martin, were erected in Coyoacan, the outskirts of Mexico City, in 1982, but they were quickly taken down after student protests.
Oh, wow.
So depictions of Melanch in art have changed over the years, too, depending on the political and social climate of
Mexico.
Absolutely,
yeah.
She's been depicted as an evil temptress and also as a Virgin Mary-like figure. Mexican feminists defend her positions because she was a slave who was caught between cultures and forced to make tough decisions. So they ultimately view her as a mother of a new race of people.
Oh, wow.
So kind of making the best out of a bad situation
yeah, absolutely. Interesting.
Yeah.
Just like the Virgin Mary conversation that we had 2 weeks ago, it's very much we found someone else who, depending on which side of the fight you're on.
Exactly.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, she's super cool.
Very cool. Yeah. Hey, everybody. If you are enjoying The Bitchery of History, check us out on Patreon. There on patreon.com/UrsulaMajor, you can help me and Allison and Jeanette and Kim, Sydney and Jess make this podcast happen. For just $1 a day, $2 a podcast, $5 a podcast, whatever you're able to contribute, you get access not only to the behind-the-scenes contributors blog, you get to see bloopers, extra scenes, deleted bits. So go to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor and join the conversation.
Hey, friends, if you are enjoying this conversation and want to have other people join in, you can easily make that happen by just looking down at whatever platform you're currently listening on and give us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks.
All right. So this week on The Bitch Tree of History, we're going to do another new segment going off what we've done in the past, where we've done a Today in History and a Term of the Week. We're going to kind of combine the two, and we're going to do something we're calling Literally Today in History.
Literally Today in History.
Literally Today in History. So today we're going to be talking about the Me Too movement and what Time Magazine is calling the Silence Breakers movement. Mm. And in particular, you know, we're going to leave the parsing of the social implications and all the political stuff to other people to necessarily parse out. And we're going to talk about the behind the scenes, like what is actually happening here and what are the different things at play. If you want to hear all the political stuff, you can go listen to Bitch With Me, where Jeanette, Kim, and I have had some long conversations about sexual assault and harassment.
Of course.
So let's start off. Allison, I'd like to hear what you think about this movement and how you as a woman feel like at this particular moment in time.
Whoo!
I know. Man. It's a lot.
It's a lot. I think what I feel is I feel a lot of different things depending mm-hmm. on the day and the time. But generally, I think I feel about three specific different things. One is relief. Mm-hmm. Like, it's way past time.
Absolutely.
Way past time. So, like, finally, we get to have this conversation. It gets to be out in the open. I think, secondly, I feel a little bit of frustration that it has taken this long and that it's taken so many stories and so many years of this occurring in silence
yeah.
for it to finally come out.
Right.
And then I think lastly, I feel a sense of pride in a strange way that I get to be part of this movement and part of this sort of revolution in making a change.
Absolutely.
And very hopeful that it is a true change and then we are able to make a cultural shift and that it's not just sort of a hot topic for a couple of months.
A moment in history.
Then, exactly. Yeah. And then it goes back to the way that it has been for far too long.
Absolutely. One of the interesting things I think has its direct ties to the election last year mm-hmm. is that we're seeing what happens when people actually get involved in the political process.
Mm.
And I think this whole Me Too movement and the reason it's being so successful is because a lot of people are finally getting involved again in the political process.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people are starting to realize that they do have avenues for pursuing their grievances and for pursuing their stories that have not had consequences for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because, you know, we've talked in the past on Bitchery about the different waves of feminism and how mm-hmm. the first wave just got women a voice and the second wave got them a seat at the table. The third started exercising that voice. And now we see the actual effects of the implementation of that voice itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we see what happens when women are empowered, when women are put into positions of power. We can actually see the effects of the social change.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty interesting the quickness that this seems to be happening.
Mm.
Now, of course, you and I, who have been doing a podcast for, what, 2.5 years at this point,
right.
have seen these kinds of trends coming. We've seen these stories for a long time. And so we know that this is not coming out of nowhere.
Right.
It's something that's been simmering just under the surface. But what do you think about the reactions from people who are saying, you know, oh my God, this happened overnight, or oh my God, this is, you know, coming out of nowhere?
I think it's a little bit naive, and I think it's a little bit of a male gaze on a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you just look at the statistics of sexual assault, not mm-hmm. even just harassment, which
right.
I think is even more difficult to fight back against
sure.
because I've had many conversations with women my own age, and it's like the minute that you text a guy back or message a guy back or even in a conversation go, whoa, that's not okay. Generally, the immediate response is, oh, well, I was joking.
Right.
You don't have a sense of humor. Like, you don't
right.
have to be so sensitive. It's you weren't joking.
Right.
That's your defense
sure.
because I'm calling you out. And so I think it's a little bit
naive because the statistics alone support the fact that many, 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 many women experience sexual assault.
Absolutely.
And so just by those numbers alone, almost every woman that you know should be able to post Me Too, mm-hmm. which is sad and disturbing and horrible. But at the same time, it's not that it's been simmering below the surface. It's not that it's a quickness of movement. It's that the instant that I saw it, I went, yep, I've been there, me too, and posted it. And so to say that it's coming out of nowhere seems to fly in the face and in denying the statistics that we all know exist and that we all know are underreported as well.
Absolutely. I wonder also, I think it's important for us to touch on the men's side of this as well, and the Me Too for the men on that side.
Yes.
And we see a lot of people saying this isn't, or men should sit down or men shouldn't speak. And I was wondering what you feel about that, because I know I have very specific views on it and I want to talk a little bit about that as well.
Sure.
But I thought I wanted to hear what you thought first.
Yeah, well, I think your experience is also probably different as well in being part of the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, has its own issues with harassment and assault and many other things. So I would absolutely, I want to hear your view on that. And I think two things. One, it is even less reported and even more underreported for men to report sexual harassment or assault. And so I have seen some men post Me Too and they tend to get a little bit of backlash almost immediately, you know, that it that's not about you and it's not your thing. And when they have explained, no, you know, this is what happened to me when I was a child or when I was in college or whatever the case may be, and they do have a legitimate case of assault or harassment, we need to be welcoming of that. And we do need to realize that it's not just an issue that faces women. It's part of the toxic masculinity in our culture, and men can be victims of that as well. On the flip side, though, it makes me think a little bit, you know, when men are saying, you know, not all men, or you should be proud to be a man, you should be apologizing for something that may have been misinterpreted in your past or whatever, because I've seen a little bit of that too, of just saying, you know, you're a good guy, so don't have a reaction to that necessarily, or don't start apologizing. What I would say to not the men who are apologizing, but the men who are saying, hey, you don't need to apologize if you're really a good guy, is it's just not your time. If I can make this parallel, which may be a little bit political, but it's like people who say when there's hashtag Black Lives Matter, replying hashtag All Lives Matter.
All lives matter.
Yes, all lives matter, but that's not the conversation that we're having right now, and that's not the movement that's happening right now.
Right.
So it's not your time.
Right.
You either can be an ally and say, I support you and I apologize or not apologize, but you know, I'm here to listen to your story and to see what changes that I can make in my behavior in the future. But it's not your time to say, well, I'm a good guy.
Right.
Or not all men. That's not part of the movement at the moment.
Right.
And so to try and take that claim back is, again, in denial of the conversation that's happening.
My thoughts, I mean, I'm right there with you, primarily for the reason that, that you say, coming from the queer community, the LGBT community, we do deal with the same issues that a lot of the female population in the world deals with, right? And that's on both the gay side and the lesbian side and the transgender side, on all the sides of the queer community. And I think as a man, if you consider yourself an ally, you have one option. If you're an ally who has not experienced sexual assault or harassment, then your voice should be used to lift people up. It's like we've talked about in the past. We've talked about what being an ally means, and we've touched on the fact that as an ally, your voice should never supersede the voices in the movement itself. Your voice should be used as a platform to then give other people the opportunity to reach places where they might not otherwise reach, right? And then your voice also in this moment, if it's not being used as an ally, if you are a survivor, then it's to say Me Too as well, because you're exactly right. I think if we are to escape the toxic masculinity that is so pervasive throughout our society, I think you do have to realize that part of toxic masculinity, like you said, is the silencing of men's voices because it is shameful or it is somehow not manly, quote unquote, not only to talk about an instance, but even to suffer in the first place from something like that. And so I find it, for me, I find it a little bit distressing when I hear people, and in, primarily it's women, who are saying, if you're a man, I need you to sit down and not talk right now. Because I don't think that that is helpful. Now, if you're saying that to someone who is bogarting a conversation or is taking it in something or is doing what you think is a bad argument, then I think then you have the opportunity and you have every right to say, look, I don't think, you know, your intentions might be right or what you're thinking might be right. But, you know, maybe let's go about it this way or let's talk about it this way. It's a chance for a constructive conversation as opposed to a don't talk about it at all. Because the way that we undo this toxic masculinity is by giving men who have grown up with it, whether wittingly or not, an avenue to come out of the toxic masculinity, a way back from the thing. And the only way to do that is to keep them a part of the conversation. Right. You know what I mean?
Because ultimately, it's all about power. I mean, sexual violence is not about a sexual act in and of itself. Right. It's about power over another person. And so you have to acknowledge that, I think, to have real change. Because what it is then when it's against someone in the queer community, it's saying what you are doing is shameful and I have power over you because of that.
Yeah.
And so that's the real issue. And yes, we do have more women in places of power and being more decision makers. And hopefully we will start to have more men, or maybe eventually solely men, who also believe in equality of power in those decision-making roles. But until then, everyone has to be part of the conversation, because our society affects everyone, whether it's designed to promote you and your ideals or not. You're still part of that system.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, I don't want to get political here, but I do think that this should be a subject that should transcend all of our political ideologies. Absolutely. Because when workplaces and political places of government are safe for everyone, then the conversations that we're able to have become more open and more free flowing. When women feel that no matter what party they belong to or what religion or political persuasion they ascribe to is safe for them to come out and express their views, then we all are richer for it. What do you hope comes from this movement? And, you know, in our study of history, where do you think this takes us?
I have a lot of varying hopes for the movement.
Okay.
I think, one, I hope that it's a chance that myself and my group as white feminists and middle class to upper class feminists can take as a moment to truly embrace intersectionality.
Yes.
There was a beautiful, beautiful letter written by women farm workers in support of the Hollywood actresses. And I think we in the feminist community should really use this as an opportunity to be open and welcoming to everyone and make sure that all voices are being heard at the table. Equality or feminist equality does not mean that a middle-class white woman gets to finish college and, you know, become the CEO of a company.
Right.
We need equality means equality. I think the other hope that I have is that it gives other women and even myself courage in the next situation where someone says something that I find uncomfortable or harassing, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
It's not even assault. It's just annoying.
Yeah.
I stand in grocery stores and hand out food samples. That's my job. And the number of men who feel the need to just touch my shoulder when they walk away, I'm just like, I just don't understand. It's not really necessary.
Right.
So just giving myself and other women courage to say, is there a particular reason that you said that, or a particular reason that you felt the need to enter a conversation in a physical manner?
Yeah.
I just had another woman who also does food sampling was telling me that someone in a store that she was in, an employee of the store, they'd kind of been chatting the whole time and they hit it off, and she gave him her card to get in touch with her about some blog that she did. And then she was putting product away in the freezer with him, And he said, hey, your number's not on this card. And she said, yeah, I don't really, you know, give my number. Right. And he said, okay, well, what about a kiss? And she turned around and he was right there in her face. Oy. And this had just happened to her. And she was telling me this. This was just a few weeks ago. And mm-hmm. I said, now is the time. Now is the time that you call the store.
Right.
And you say, look, this happened. And she said, yeah, you know, but maybe it's just an isolated thing. And he seemed right. really apologetic, but he has been texting me and just sort of right. this back and forth. And I just... I have been in the situation where it's like, I don't know if I want to say something or not say something, but I do hope it mm-hmm. gives women more courage, because I told her, I said, I don't want to go and work in that store now that I've heard.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
I don't know who that guy is. I feel unsafe. And I don't think it's an isolated thing.
Right.
And
you know, that's interesting, because it is, that relates to a larger conversation that I think we could also have about, you know, now that we're having this moment where mm-hmm. sexual assault and misbehavior is mm-hmm. finally being held to account, the conversation that we have to have next, and that we really are not doing a very good job right now of having, is mm-hmm. what are the consequences?
Yeah.
And how do we differentiate between the different varying layers?
Right. What's the sliding scale?
Because you do have women who come forward and say, look, it was an isolated incident and I don't want to ruin, you know, this entire guy's life. But then, you know, you have a binary where you're either ruining a guy's life completely or you're letting him get away with, you know, treating women this way. And where do you find the happy medium in the middle?
Right. So yeah, my hope is just generally that it gives more women the courage to speak up, and to speak up in the moment.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking to me to hear, you know, this happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and yeah. I'm just now finding the courage to speak out. I think if we can start speaking up more instantly and in the moment, it will become easier to investigate
mm-hmm.
and to have consequences that are equal to the incident.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we start feeling safer as a society.
Right.
And I don't have to run with pepper spray in the morning.
Absolutely. I guess my hope for the future is, what I hope is that eventually we can get to a point where we can believe all women when they come forward with stories like this, mm. but still hold men to a system where they have their day in court. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You can believe women and still believe that someone is innocent until proven guilty.
Correct.
Just like someone can be accused of murder but not go to jail for it until a jury of their peers sends them to jail for it. The degrees of the problem and right. the reactions to that problem
right.
as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Our cause of the week this week, I wanted to highlight a great organization called Just Be.
Yes.
It was founded about 10 years ago by Tarana Burke.
Mm-hmm.
And she is really the founder of the Me Too movement, or at least she was the first 10 years ago mm-hmm. to give her movement a name, Me Too. Her corporation, or her nonprofit, Just Be, is an organization that helps victims of sexual harassment and assault. And she started this because she wasn't finding the resources that she needed and that we all need mm-hmm. as a society. And so after this Me Too movement came out and really started to take steam, a lot of people said, you know, we shouldn't be leaving her out of this story.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's probably thanks to her that some women, or hopefully many women and yeah. men and other survivors throughout these past 10 years have had somewhere to go and to turn to. And I guess my hope for the future would be that Just Be goes out of business.
Yes.
And we don't need it
That'd
anymore.
That'd be awesome. What was the website again?
The website is justbeinc.org. That's justbeinc.org.
Fantastic. All right. Well, The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions.
You can join the conversation on all of our social media platforms. Facebook.com, just search The Bitchery of History. We're also on Twitter at BitcheryPod, Instagram at The Bitchery of History.
You can also help us make this production happen at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
We couldn't make this podcast happen without our incredible production team. That's Kim,
Jeanette,
Jess,
and Sydney.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. If you're looking for a new podcast from the creators of The Bitchery of History, you can find Bitch With Me on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.